Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Rugby Wrap-Up. I'm Matt McCarthy at Studio 34 at the Fantasy Sports Networks, and we have a dandy for you in our kickoff show. We have some heavyweights from the rugby world, including Mr. Lou Stanfill, the three-time Rugby World Cup Eagle. He is a massive man, both on and off the pitch, and actually pretty funny. So we're going to put a lot of pressure on him to be funny here today, Lou. Steve Lewis, the former COO of the one and only professional rugby setup in the United States that is now arguably not going to continue into its second season, the pro rugby setup. He is also one of the most highly celebrated sevens coaches in the United States. And then we've got the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Dan Lyle, the original Captain America, transformed rugby in the Premiership, specifically with Bath. He is an NBC analyst and the director of...
You got it. It's rugby.
Director of rugby for AEG, which is an enormous company making
this is the rugby wrap-up show, right?
This is the rugby wrap-up show, yes. Sure. Yeah, I just had a check. So, gentlemen, we've also got it waiting in the wings, another former Eagle for Team USA, Mr. Tony Ridnell, who is also an attorney and a rebel blogger. All right, so we'll get to him, too. But first up, we're going to keep this kind of informal. We're going to chat about rugby because that's what we're here to do. And I want to start off with the reason why we're all here in Nueva York. Team USA kicking off their summer tour, whatever we call it. Guys, what do we think of the state of USA rugby right now? Luke?
I'm pretty optimistic about it. The level of turnover we've had from domestic players being completely amateur and not really having all that many resources, you know, from about 4 years ago to the point where we're at now has been pretty commendable. A lot of young guys are getting themselves into good programs. They're giving them the resources at least to train like professionals, right? Whereas before, you know, maybe we had half the guys that were domestic playing on the Eagles that had that opportunity. So it's a pretty good opportunity for the Eagles to, you know, take on a full Ireland international side that is, you know, they're missing a few players because of the Lions tour. And it's a great opportunity for us, just like in, I want to say it was 2013. Yeah, 13. Yeah. And a very similar situation.
And you were in that was a great match down in Houston, or Houston, depending on where you're from. And that was what, was that 15-13? Something.
It was a pretty close game.
Yeah, yeah. Steve, you handled a lot of the Team USA players in the pro rugby setup. What was that like getting those guys to transition from only playing club rugby into a professional atmosphere?
Yeah, well, I think it was one of the benefits of pro rugby was that some of these guys were able to enjoy or be exposed to daily training environments, which they hadn't before. I think many of them struggled, many of them prospered, and actually quite a few of those guys have come through now and are performing pretty well with the national team. So I think from that perspective, it was a success because it introduced, say, 150 American players who hitherto had not got up every day and done rugby, and they were able to do that. So that hopefully will be, you know, we'll see the results of that hopefully in the next couple of years.
Dan, you've been around the longest. You've played the most, the highest level for an Eagle, really, for the longest period of time, and you came at a time when there was nothing going on, really, so to speak, in the United States. You had to make your name in England. What's the biggest thing that's changed for you watching the transition of the level of competition?
Yeah, it's probably a good question because we're in this bar, right? Well, we're in this great studio, which is fantastic. Congratulations and thanks for having us here. But we're in this bar. I think it's a forever barroom conversation, guys, right? Where do we have the athletes? Are we training enough? What do we look like compared against big international sides? I mean, this Ireland side beat England and beat New Zealand in the last couple. They're number three in the world because for that very reason. Yeah, and as Lou said, they've got a few guys out, but we've lost to them the last two times. Actually, that was in 13 and in 09 when the Lions tours were going on that we did the same thing. So we've got our challenge up against you. I think back when the 70s and 80s, when we knew that we had some really good athletes, guys were crossing over from football, then we kind of had that period of time where we didn't know. And now are we back at that place where do we have a training environment and athletes playing and involved? Do we have the athletes? Do we have the rugby IQ? You know, perfectly honest, I don't know. I think that that's the biggest issue for American rugby right now is to do one of those really comprehensive high performance audits and really put in front of the American public, like everybody, every coach, every person that's listening to this, every person that watches on television, what do we look like against the five teams above us and below us? What do we look like, you know, athletically, metrically? How fast does Lou run, jump, and all that kind of stuff? But what do we look like rugby
IQ-wise? Lou is lightning fast.
Yeah, I know he's not playing anymore. But, you know, Lou was, you know, he played three World Cups.
Known for his speed.
You didn't play in any. So
that you know of.
Not those kind of World Cups. In that regard, we don't know. If you're going to make this about something else, we can go there, Matt. But I thought this was a serious conversation.
You're right. Go ahead. Continue.
The long and short of it is that if we don't have an audit where every person in America, and even in people from abroad, understand what we look like, so people can go, okay, look, we just don't have enough props that can run as fast as the props ahead of them, or they just don't have enough scrums under their belt, you know, then we need to figure that out. And that's the missing gap for every coach in America to decide whether his or her program, this is men and women, sevens and 15s, right? And once we have that data, I think that we can say, where does rugby sit in America comparative to other people? That's the first thing I would do, is a comprehensive high-performance audit and stop the barroom stool conversation of, do we have the best athletes or not playing the game?
I completely agree with Dan. Like, there needs to be an audit of our athletes, the level of IQ that they have, the level of understanding of the game, the level of understanding of what their team is trying to do. I mean, these things are all...
Time on the job, right?
Exactly. They need the experience to know what it is they're going into each situation doing. I've recently made that transition from player into coach, and I coach high school rugby boys, and I see a majority of the teams that we play that were the same teams I used to play against in high school doing the same things. And I think that audit needs to kind of cover more ground than just the players. I think it needs to cover a little bit more into the coaching, and it needs to cover a little bit more in depth about a little bit more honesty. What are you trying to do? How are we trying to do it? How can we help improve?
I think what you and I were starting to talk about in the banter is, I agree with you, and Steve can probably jump into this as a more significant coach. That's not something I, you know, did afterwards and so forth. I think the high performance audit is a tool, right, to then go into the two primary things that American rugby could use that tool for. One is program building. Right? How do you make a better program that's on and off the field? And coach development, right? Because coaches are, in essence, just like in America, we invented the word coach, right? The coacher in baseball. Mm-hmm. I mean, we kind of know that word, but the coach all of a sudden is like the GM and everything. He controls a lot of things. And so we need to kind of Americanize the dialogue between programs, you know, versus clubs in America.
Yeah.
I love clubs, and we should think that word out, but what's a program? What's a club? You know, what's coach development look like? And the high performance audit, I think, because it tells us what we look like, you know, then we're able to use that data and instruct our coaches about, you know, what they need to do.
It's a good point. And Steve, you have the academy side too.
Yeah, and so with the Northeast Academy, for instance, and other sort of ODAs, Olympic Development Academies like Tiger, Atavis, other people like that, there's this assumption it's all about player development, but coaching development is about player development. If we don't have the coaches, those players don't develop. So it has been neglected. USA Rugby, despite the best efforts of some at the national office, the coaching development pathway hasn't been there. And so that is one very big quick fix to get that, to get a program, get it as part of a program, get that on track.
Well, I remember my former teammate and then coach, Tom Billups, when he left the USA Rugby in 2006. The conversation back then was, if not Tom, then who, right? And now we're facing that same situation right now with John Mitchell leaving, right? So and so forth. And it's like, if not John, then who? So because we don't have an established, this is the first division, you know, and this is the next level, or we don't have I don't think it's a panacea job of you just get to come in and coach the national team. You got to do a lot more than that. We talked about it on the way over here, on the walk over here, Matt. You know, it's like, you don't really, there's not like a 10 guys that come to your mind that are Americans, or, and I don't mean Americans by way of accent, I just mean people that are going to live here for a long time, but from a sense that those are the natural 10, you know? And I think you can say that again, men and women, sevens and 15s.
Right, but a significant part of the new head coach's remit should be coach development. So it's coaching the team, the national team. It's evangelizing the game, getting out there, spreading the word, being the face of the program. But one of the biggest parts is helping other coaches develop.
Well, maybe or maybe not. Like basketball today, Ohio State just hired Butler's coach, right? Young right. guy, right? He had 3 years at Gardner-Webb, yeah. you know, and then 3 years at Butler. Took him to three successive yeah. sweets. Took him to Sweet 16 and all that kind of stuff. He's more of a person that's going to be a player development driven guy and all that kind of stuff. So I don't want to necessarily pigeonhole. You know, we need coach development, we need player development, and we need referee development. And I don't think that coach that comes in is necessarily going to be the sage coach that's going to say, well, what if we find a 35-year-old stud that identifies with players and can get after it, willing to travel, all that kind of stuff. So I'm just saying that I agree, we need it. You're
that,
exactly
that would
right.
require us to actually have a job description.
Here's a question.
That's called a plan, right?
Is there a potential future head coach of Team USA's Men 15s team sitting next to me right here?
Hey, Steve, you look like you can do the job.
I think I'm more in the seventh world these days.
I mean, who knows? Anything's possible. I don't have any plans to commit myself to that sort of endeavor. And, you know, the one thing I've really realized is as I, again, made that transition into the real world, got to go get a job, got to pay bills. Rugby at this present moment does not provide you with that platform as an adult. If you're going to do it, it's out of passion. It's out of the will to want to do it because you're working with people that they're keeping a club afloat, right? They're donating hours upon hours, you know, sometimes upwards to, you know, 25 to 30 a week just to make sure that the club is operating, which is a fantastic thing.
Right.
The issue is that, you know, things start chipping away, you know, family life happens, other things happen, they need extra money, and they can't provide that sort of commitment to the club. I'm real fortunate because the program I'm a part of has that support group where it's going to continue going on no matter if I'm involved or if I'm not. Jesuit High School has a long reputation of yeah. being operable and always having a team and always feeling a team, and no matter what happens, and next year a group of kids come up.
So let's say at the national team level, the first program that we had is the U.S. Sevens team, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because all of a sudden you have a Olympic training center, you know, maybe extremely small amounts of money, but you have an ability to build systems. So where if that coach or that structure, and we've had Al and we've had Mags and we've had Mike, if they go away, the system's still there, right? It might suffer, it might not. But we have a program, and I think that if we think about program building, that means that it's sustainable regardless of the personalities, right? And that's where coaches can come into those type of environments and thrive. So those we got to create those more and more of those environments.
I think we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're gonna have Tony Ridnell step in here real quick. Give me real fast your choices for the next head coach for Team USA to replace John Mitchell. Go ahead.
Donald Trump.
Don't know who's available.
When Mike Tolkien got the job, there was Mike Tolkien, Dave Hodges, and Tom Billups, coach development, player development, coaching the team, and all so forth. If we have that type of triumvirate, and I'm not talking those three, necessarily those three guys, if they even want to do it, but that type of conversation makes a lot of sense to me. So as Steve said, you're not picking one person. You're creating a system that can go in place. So I think we need to look beyond just the one
just
person.
Just the one person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with more, and we'll have Mr. Tony Ridnell joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, only in rugby can a guy that was a really crappy rugby player sit at a table with three guys that were Eagles and actually talk rugby with some semblance of professionalism. So I want to thank you guys, and specifically Mr. Steve Lewis, for also being here today. But Tony, you have a reputation as perhaps a bit of a rebel when it comes to USA Rugby, to put it mildly. You've been listening in the back over
sure.
there. What do you make of all the stuff that we're talking about?
Well, I think the input from all three guys has been excellent, and it's pretty humbling sitting between Lou and Dan, two of the greatest American rugby players ever. And congratulations on your new space here.
Yeah.
I wouldn't consider myself a rebel at all. I was called divisive during my board interview recently. But rebel is not the right word. Holding to account, raising standards, ensuring standards are met, ensuring that plans are implemented and executed, that we really haven't been doing too much. I don't consider that being a rebel. I consider that being a rugby patriot to the United States.
A rugby patriot. Interesting. You were also talking about metrics and accountability for that. So how does that mesh? And what do we do to what can we build in there, like, immediately to help these guys? Because it's more of a help than it is. You know, you want to know how you're doing. And I remember when the Navy SEALs came into rugby camp during the World Cup, and they were talking about how are you measuring just your basic things, like they're talking to the scrum heads. Are you measuring where your box kicks are like a landing? Are you measuring what where you're placing the ball? And they were like, well, no, not really, right?
Mm-hmm. So that's like any successful organization. It's about creating standards and goals, measuring, making sure you're meeting those goals. And that's on and off the field.
I think you have to.
You might have to get a little closer, Dan.
Yeah. Well, I think you have to. Sport is a business as much as anything else. It's a pretty fragile business, right? There's a lot of fragility because athletes come and go, yeah. And so the only thing that's going to be left is your plan, and so you've got to run it like a business, and you're going to have an infrastructure. USA Rugby has historically been really bad at that. We haven't created a business environment, as well as a plan that goes against a strategic direction. So I think that's something that. That not only the USA Rugby has to do, but when people say, are you growing the game in America? I'm like, well, it's not one market. It's 12 to 16 markets at best.
It's an enormous country.
It's an enormous country. And so you've got to have each of those markets, and those markets pretty much pick themselves on the coast and a few internally that pick themselves by way of rugby density, by way of athletes, by way of, facilities, infrastructure, kids playing the game. They pick themselves. And once you pick those, then you've got to get that a localized group of people actually developing the game as well and creating a business platform for it as well. So USA Rugby needs to do a better job of saying, hey, we believe that the business of the game is X, Y, and Z. We believe that this is what we own, and this is what we're going to try to monopolize by way of commoditizing things. This is what we want to go out partner, and this is kind of our kerosene bucket where we want to spread it like wildfire, right?
Right.
And then try to duplicate or give those tools to those same 12 to 16 markets. And it's a bit of a chessboard. Not everybody will, and it becomes concentric circles from there. Certainly, that feels like the right thing. And I think that takes people from inside and outside the game. I think for too long we've been too, it's about American rugby expertise, right? Versus there's a lot of people, and I've become aware of this through working with NBC, through working with AEG, through working with a lot of partners, a lot of people out there that want to be involved in rugby. They're just not a really good front door, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, hey,
yeah.
There's people knocking on the side door, and hey, we're not here to... to break in, we're here to help clean the house,
So speaking of breaking in, I mean, we broke in with our first ever pro rugby setup last year. Looks like it's not going to happen necessarily the sophomore season, as we said earlier. What about the MLR? What about other setups? The reality of the MLR, Pro 12 coming in, what do you guys think of that?
It's going to be a pretty big effort. Steve, he'll know better than anyone else, having worked in the inside what was going on with pro rugby. This is so much responsibility to have to take on to one person. Like Dan's saying, that decentralized leadership has to happen where the idea, or rather the central ethos, has to be carried out from the top organization to each individual club. And I feel that's where pro kind of came up short, and maybe MLR can do it. I don't know. I don't know too many of these people who are involved. It sounds like they all want to get it done, but whether or not they have the tools, whether or not they have the support, and whether or not they have the culture that is already kind of created out of the very beginning of this, is yet to be seen. I'm always optimistic. Anytime someone comes up and says, I got a bunch of money, I want to throw it at rugby, right? Everyone wants to see them do well. The problem is that it takes so much more than that, and it takes a whole lot more individuals to really be involved to kind of help make that succeed.
Tony, what's your take on the MLR?
Well, I do know a few of the people. Ken Rivera at Utah, Richard Osborne at Austin, the guys up in Glendale, Adrian and David in Seattle. And they've done a pretty good job. I mean, they've really worked hard off the ball, off the field, visualizing what it's going to look like. They've limited the number of clubs. There are other clubs that I know are looking to join but haven't met sort of the requirements that will be necessary either financially or in the stands. So I'm pretty excited about it. I think the major downfall of pro rugby last year was the failure of community outreach. It was amazing that they got the product on the field on time, and that's a real tribute to Steve. But I think the community outreach, which is really what rugby's all about, the ability me to maybe go to Bath and call up someone that knows Dan and to be able to stay at their house.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what rugby's about, and we've got that community, and I think that's where they really missed out. That I believe MLR, if they go right, it could get off the ground. I'm pretty excited about it. I really am. I'll support it 100%.
Dan, $30 a ticket, that won't work.
Yeah, that's not going to fly in the beginning. No way.
We got a minute. We have a minute left, Dan. 30 seconds on the MLR.
Yeah, well, if it's
which is impossible, right?
MLR, the people behind it are the traditional clubs in America, right? And every system around the world has generally, from the beginnings of the NFL and the NHL to the advent of professionalism abroad, has been the commoditizing of existing structure with the occasional growth of something new, you know, like the Utah example. Yeah. So I think that we have to grow the structures that we have, right, and try to create that affinity and that dialogue. It fits well within that market strategy. Mm-hmm. It fits well within that projection that Tony talked about the 2027 World Cup or those markets. There's a lot of things that fit within that. Maybe there's two other conferences with the MLR. You right now it's not the East and the West Coast, which is a lot harder to do rugby in a lot of ways, even though there's more density and so forth. You know, the financial model is a lot harder because you've got to pay more and do more, right? But maybe that's a three conference system over time, and how do the English Premiership, the Pro 12, and the Super Rugby fit into that conversation? But that to me is the structure of a plan that then is underwritten by a business plan below it. And that becomes an all-in. And we're all into that conversation. And then we're all into that from a sense of how we're going to make that work and create the affinity towards those clubs. So that every kid that's playing on Jesuit that Lou coaches, and every kid that plays for Xavier, they know where their club is. They know the catchment area.
They also know where they can aspire to.
Right.
As well.
That's what affinity means. Yeah.
Okay. There we have it. We have a couple of big fellas exchanging the vocabulary. They have bigly vocabularies, these guys. But in all seriousness, fellas, is a conversation that we continue. It's a great thing that we can actually see ourselves here talking rugby in the United States like this, right? And we'll be back with a little bit more. Specifically, we'll pick up with our predictions for USA Rugby in the upcoming matches. Be right back. So we are continuing into our last segment, and we have Mr. Steve Lewis back in the Tony Ridnell seat. Gentlemen, let's talk about specifics with USA Rugby in this summer, June international, whatever you want to call it, tour, summer tours. We have a big match against Ireland. Let's go first off with predictions on the Ireland match. Lou.
I'm an optimist, so obviously I'm going to say the boys are going to come out. They're going to play well. Some of the conversations I've had with some of the older veterans on the team says that they've had a good camp. They've been put in the same positions we've been put in before, but the guys that are involved are ready to go, and that they're ready to go bash head. So I say USA by three.
The Scotsman.
As a fellow Celt, I have to go with the Irish. I think it's a vulnerable Irish team in the sense that it's relatively inexperienced. 10 guys, 10 of the team with less than 10 caps, whatever it might be. However, that may not work to our advantage because these are guys who are playing for a reputation. Yeah. They want that green jersey. So to underestimate them or to look at the Irish team as weak because they're missing 12 with the Lions, be a mistake. I am hoping our guys get it done. I think the longer they stay in the game, the better it could be. It's going to be 86 tomorrow. It's going to be hot. This is an opportunity for them to knock off a tier one team, and why not do it here in New York or New Jersey? But Ireland by 15.
15.
As the only American that has beaten Ireland.
Oh, snap.
When was that?
That was for the Barbarians in the Give It to Jonas tour. I did the sideline for the All Black Ireland game, and we in the prediction of that game, it was the All Blacks were going to win that game. But right at the end of it, the Lee Diffie, who does a lot of the chair, mm-hmm. Said,
"The Aussie,
what do you think?" And I said, "Well, so I didn't say that Ireland couldn't win, but here's the things they need to do, And so, we've got to play 14 out of 10 in order to win this game. And that's what Ireland needed to do that game. So the level of control that gets us late into that game in the heat, the level of I think that AJ McGinty, and his foot, and I thought that maybe, that would be a significant factor. This is a game that if he stands out, you know, and I don't know if whether him or Ben Seamer are going to kick for points either, you know what I mean? But, you know, we've got to really control the possession of the ball. And if we control the possession of the ball, and that's not about controlling contact. That's not about controlling, you know, the kick chase game. That's not about – it's about the overall game. And that's what was so impressive me in that Ireland All-Black game, is that they controlled the game. They controlled the pace of the game. They controlled the kicking exchange of the game. They controlled the contact area of the game. That meant that they played that 12 or 13 out of 10. And I think that – obviously, we've never beaten a Tier 1 country, right? So you have to think of – that you have to play at a plateau level that you don't think you're capable of. But wouldn't it be, per what we talked about earlier, wouldn't it be really cool though if everybody that knew rugby or kind of was pretty knowledgeable about rugby knew what every player looked like against his opposite, you know, that you could actually do a comparable of that physical metrics we were talking about, and then kind of, because then you'd say, well, maybe we're a little bit better at this position physically, but we know that we're less, you know, or AJ McGinty is great there as well, and he's a professional, so we actually were up on that one. And you could almost do like the American statistical dialogue of, we know what we look like compared against the other ones. I think that's, when we get to that level, then all of us will be a lot more gifted in our ability to say what is
make
and what
the
isn't.
Predictions. Yeah. You know,
this is going to be a tough day. Control is the key for me.
Yeah.
Hey, but Mitchie's game is all about tempo, right? So all their thing is about practicing with intensity and then playing with intensity. So the longer the US team can do that, they can start to make this a little uncomfortable for the Irish, hopefully, between an Irish team that's not played together, an Irish team that's away from home. It's the start of their summer.
Let me ask you a question as a coach, though. Against every Tier 1 or every big club we played under Mitchell, Maori All Blacks and things like that, we've played the single line attack. We looked with maybe some width to our game, but it didn't really look. But against the ARC, all of a sudden we got two lines attack, people passing behindwards, and it's like, are we just expending too much energy up front and we can't get to that? Or does he have two different – I was confused when I'm watching those two different, you know, those two different dynamics.
Well, you also had different the opponents were
right, but that's what
different.
I'm asking. Yeah. You know,
I think you've seen a development. There's been a transition. There's been an improvement. And again, AR6, a lower level of quality, perhaps. But so, what will we see tomorrow? Will they be able to successfully translate that against T1 opposition, against full time professionals? So that's going to be the test.
You know, here's one thing that I did notice last time you saw AJ around, but McGinty, you know, he was a kid that was getting the start number 10 the last time we were together really for the World Cup and everything else. You see him now. He's the same guy. He's loose, but he looks and exudes the confidence of a professional. That's just the take I got from him 15 minutes talking to him out at Drew University at Eagles camp. And that... He's actually beaten Sexton head to head for Connacht against Leinster, right? So that's another thing that he's got under his belt. He could be the X factor here.
Yeah, there's a couple of key matchups, right? McGinty, Carberry is one of them. Carberry is like the golden boy of Irish rugby coming through. So that's significant. I also think front row is going to be very telling. I think if we can survive there, or we can compete there, survive, then that will help. That has typically been a vulnerability in American teams over the last 4 or 5 years. I think we've seen a significant improvement.
I'm interfering again. Why isn't Joe playing?
Why isn't he starting? You mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think if you read between the lines, tomorrow is a fantastic occasion, but tomorrow is not what this summer is about. This summer is about beating Canada home and away. So you have absences. Cam Dolan's not there. Todd Clever's not there.
Blaine Scully's not there.
Blaine's out for the summer.
No, but they're in the squad, but they're not playing tomorrow.
Right.
So
right.
Perhaps Mitch is holding a couple of people back for the later games, which are the important games.
I guess so. You know, but I just want to tip my cap real quickly here to Todd Clever, because when you mentioned the Ireland matches, that guy left everything on the pitch when they played. And I know he's getting a little older, and there's a lot more competition. But I just wanted to salute his accomplishments and say that it's kind of, for me, not going to be the same, but I understand it.
It's the evolution. I mean, you want Todd out there because he brings an energy that everyone else feels he feeds off of, but he can't play forever.
Right.
And so you need to be able to have guys pick up that slack and someone else to fill that role, or for a couple people to fill that role. And I think it's a good opportunity for the team.
It's not all roses, right? What we have to talk about here is, like, I think This Is American Rugby, or somebody did a quote with John Mitchell about you know, how are you addressing that you're departing into the game? Because you're exactly right, Steve. This is about the two final games of, sure. Of the summer or you know, the two Canada games and so forth. I don't think any of us know because we don't have that, you know, this is the standard American press now. You
sure.
know, it's the blog conversation, sure. right? We don't have that entrenched journalist that's there asking that question over and over again of what's going on here. So we're left to speculate. And I don't think it's wrong to say that you're resting people, but you know, you and I, we could debate all till we're blue in the face. Would I rest those guys now? I get four games in a row of really tough. It's kind of funny because Canada are resting the majority of their team versus Georgia.
And that's fantastic competition for them. I'm sure there's
some structure going on. Obviously, Mitch is a fantastic pedigree coach, but from a sense of, I don't, you know, it's hard to speculate what we're doing right now.
But if I was the coach, I got 28 players, four games, you prioritize.
Yeah,
perhaps he's prioritizing.
Absolutely, and that's not what I'm saying is that we're not being overly critical. It's just that it's hard to read where we are. When we're coming into a summer where we played the ARC, and this is almost like a completely different dialogue, you know, because of that.
Two levels up.
Absolutely.
And I got to tell you, we're out of time. This flew by for me. I don't know about you guys, but I want to thank you again. And that was a thrill. That was great. We're going to have more of this stuff to come. The likes of you guys make it special. They know what they're talking about. They're serious about it. They're passionate about rugby like we hope you are. And I'm going to predict that the Eagles beat Ireland by 6 points tomorrow in an epic upset in the heat in my backyard in New Jersey. Newark and Harrison, how you doing? For Matt, for Dan Lyle, Steve Lewis, Lou Stanfill, Tony Ridnell, I'm Matt McCarthy for Rugby Wrap-Up at Studio 34 for Fantasy Sports Network here in New York City, signing off.